Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Here I am, live in Austin, Texas, like, wait, I'm on the West Coast. I'm here at Tom Merritt's place. How are you?
I'm good. And Justin Robert Young?
Hi, everybody. I'm in Oakland like I normally am. That's different.
Well, like
than
a normal
Brian
person
is.
Would be. Not a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the video listeners, real quick, can you just give us a timeline? I mean, the answer can be forever, Justin, but do you have a timeline on how long you're going to be rocking the amazing Anchorman look?
Yes, I do. It will be specifically timed to June 30th when the new Kickstarter game Action News launches, and then I'll probably keep it throughout that whole time. So everybody get buckle up. Because through July, you will have this mustache in your life.
Hey, Brian, do you have a time frame for how long your face is going to be doing that thing?
The answer is until we have to do reshoots for the TV project that Bryce and I are working on, and I have to shave my beard.
No, I just mean your face, Brian. Stuff. Just your whole face. Oh,
no, forever. Right. It'll be affectionately looking at you.
Oh, Brian, how did you turn my sick burn into that? Now I feel weird. Gentlemen, glad you're laughing. That's going to come to an end. You know why?
Why?
This is an extra spooky episode of Weird Things.
Oh, my God. It doesn't have to do with aliens in space, does it? Because that would be scary.
Dude, if it's a Stephen King kind of scary, then the answer is probably yes.
Oh,
but it deals with spooks and ghosts and spirits and I'm going to start off with the first story. Ted Bundy.
In space?
No, Ryan. No, I said okay. No. I said, unless you want to make this into a Stephen King story, it's always aliens.
I mean, okay. I'm just saying. Theoretically, we could send part of it.
No, Brian, you got your dark trailer, so just be happy, okay?
Okay, all right.
I'm trying to kingify this. So, headline, and I'm going to see if you guys can guess where this is going. This is from, originally from the Star Telegram. The headline here is some spooky things are happening at serial killer Ted Bundy's childhood home.
Okay, so I'm going to assume, Justin, back my play on this, or don't.
All right.
I'm going to assume that nobody from his family still lives there, and that the people who live there now, who bought it, only have the vague knowledge that Ted Bundy used to live here. And that would kind of up your radar for weird things, right? And then, and if that's the case, you're gonna be like, "Well, that was weird." Also, this is Ted Bundy's home.
So your contention is that they are not aware necessarily of Ted Bundy specifically or his family, but now that weird things are happening, it's become a way to brand it as like, oh, this isn't just that cereal box didn't just fall off that counter. Like, it was Ted Bundy, ghost.
And specifically, I'm saying they are aware that Ted Bundy at some point lived in the house, which now becomes the excuse for anything unusual. Like, I thought I set this thermostat to 73. Now it's at 72. By the way, did you know this is Ted Bundy's old house?
All right. Can I introduce some facts into this and
yeah,
see
please.
If you can explain?
Let's mix those in.
Number one, it's a contractor. It's a contractor who's hired to refix the house. And I don't know if you ever saw Session 9, which is one of the spookiest movies, I think, in the genre. It's about contractors working on an insane asylum. It's scary, and they're legitimate people. So contractors, Brian, contractors, not homeowners. Unexplainable things happened in the Tacoma house where the serial killer Ted Bundy grew up. So many things. In fact, the contractor hired to remodel the home penciled Bible scriptures on the walls and brought in two pastors to bless the house. Not one, Brian. Too, because you know Fred the pastor, we're a little bit unsure about his faith in the faith.
Dude, okay, well, yeah. Any IT professional knows this is a redundant array of independent pastors, or as is commonly called a rape.
Yes. So I'm not one to believe in this stuff, but this house made me a believer, said Casey Clopton, the contractor. A cry for help appeared on a window as crew members worked in the basement. Heavy furniture webbed into a wall toppled over. Doors and cabinets seemed to open themselves. It all started in September when David Truong bought the 1,400 square foot home with plans to redo and flip it. Flip this murder serial killer house. He didn't research its history, so he didn't know the local lore or who had lived there.
Hold on. Was this a new HGTV series? Flip this former murderer's house.
I'm pitching that next week.
Artifact of murder.
That would be a great show. I would so tune in.
Like that's a pitch. How is that not on? I mean, like the two hottest things for women ages 15 to 45 are true crime and HGTV television. Like this is a no brainer.
It does seem like a slam dunk, dude. I'm not gonna lie.
So they go on to talk about how he would never murdered anybody in the house, but he grew up in the house. One of the neighbors says, "I don't remember ever seeing Ted," said Hope Murray, a neighbor who grew up a few houses down and later bought her childhood home. She recalls playing with Bundy's younger sisters and Louise Bundy babysitting her. Once she went to their house, but was told to stay out of Ted's bedroom because he had the measles. They were a really nice family, Murray said. Bundy insisted he grew up in a wonderful home with two dedicated, loving parents, which seems to be the MO for him. His mom was a long, staunch defender of him. Some insisted he was innocent. Her stance softened after he made several death row confessions. They go on a little about Bundy, how he said that it all stemmed from his obsession with pornography, which is why the internet has turned us all into a bunch of raving serial killers. Yeah. Some think that he may have killed at 14, that Anne Marie Burr, an 8-year-old girl abducted from North End home in August, was his first, in 61, was his first victim. Anyhow, goes on, but Bundy denied it, and why would a serial killer lie to you? So it goes on to explain, once the stuff happened, the contractor Clopton first visited the house after he was hired in October. He took along his 11-year-old daughter, who sometimes go with him and takes dictated notes from her dad about the work that needs to be done, called Child Services. "My daughter started crying," Clopton said. "She said she felt weird. She didn't like it there." Okay. "She refused to be alone in the house and was so uncomfortable they left quickly." Clopton returned the next week with a demolition crew, not the band. One crew member echoed the sentiment that the house didn't feel right. Then things started happening. Things he kept dismissing as pranks among the crew. There was a time they re-entered the house, which had been locked, and every door, every cabinet drawer was open. Or the time workers were cleaning up the flooded basement and spotted the words, "Help me," written on the glass. A screwed-on screen protector would have made it difficult for someone to write it, he said. A heavy dresser inserted into the upstairs hallway somehow pulled itself out and landed face down on the floor while the crew was downstairs. Workers said it takes at least one strong man to pull it down. There's no way it could have fallen down on its own. So a lot of weird things kept happening, guys. So electronics would get unplugged, like cell phones, and charges would die. The word "leave" was found written sheetrock dust on a bedroom floor with no footprints around it.
Can I confess something? There was a friend of mine in Magic back in the day, and around the time, end of high school, early college, I got into painting on the ceiling of my bedroom, and whoever would let me, exact copies of the constellations, so that with glow-in-the-dark paint. So you saw nothing during the lights on, but then the lights off, and then the glow-in-the-dark paint, it looked like you were looking up at the stars and so on. there was a friend of mine in Magic that I took a different bent, because the way that you make so you set up the stars in the right position, and then what you do is you take the glow-in-the-dark paint and you dilute it with water, and then you rub a toothbrush in it and you kind of brush your thumb over the bristles and it flings it out, right? And this is a way for you to make kind of nebulas or create the Milky Way across the sky. So I skipped all the stars, and without his knowledge, I just made the water and glow-in-the-dark paint mix, and then using just my thumb and a toothbrush, brushed out the faintly glowing phrase, "Get out," that would greet him every night after he turned off the light and went to bed. So I'm just going to say that there's precedent for people just doing stuff to be total assholes.
And never telling. I've maybe been aware of people who've done things to other people and then never told them. Because after a period of time, like, man, it's kind of great that they don't know.
And that's what happens. It's like when you do it, you swear to yourself, like, oh, I'll tell them, I'll let them off the hook, it'll be great. I'll just wait until I hear something from them. But of course, when somebody wakes up in the middle of the night and sees a portent of Satan's interest in them, very unlikely they're going to go to their casual magic friend and say, like, I think the devil reached out to me last night. And so instead, you kind of never get around to that point of letting them off the hook. And it's like, whoops.
So are we going to say in this situation, we're kind of, hey, somebody was having fun, found out it was Ted Bundy's house, decided to do this, and, you know.
I mean, I love that it's been dismissed out of hand that these aren't pranks, right? Because it's like, initially all this stuff happens, and let, you know, Guido McContractor is just like, hey, boys, like, you better knock this off. Like, this is really, this is a problem.
Real quick, Guido McContractor, is he Italian? Is he Scottish? Is he Irish?
Clopton, Clopton.
Yeah, no, he's American, goddammit, and you're not going to get it.
All right, fair enough.
He's yelling at everybody who's doing it, and he's like, hey, you guys better stop screwing around. Swear to God, boss, we ain't doing nothing. Okay, ghosts, let's get the pastors in here. Like, you know,
let me read this to you. He eventually chatted some of the neighbors about the odd occurrences, asking if they had been a rash of break-ins, which that's obviously the next assumption. That's when they told him Bundy lived in the house. They passed along to the real estate broker, said he was shocked but excited by the discovery because he has an interest in true crime. Okay, weirdo.
It was
really eerie but really neat, he said. We made sure to keep quiet initially because we weren't sure how people would react to knowing a serial killer lived there, you know, the people you're trying to sell your house to. Although a handful of potential buyers asked Pitts about Bundy once calling the house home, he said the people who recently bought the house, they didn't ask. It's unclear whether the new owners are aware. They are unable to be reached for comment.
So here's the valid question, and I want to go all the way around the horn on this one, including Bryce. Would you buy a piece of prime real estate at, let's not even say a discounted rate, like it's just solid real estate? This is terribly morbid to even say, but it's like, would you buy the home where the murder-suicide of Phil Hartman took place? Would you buy it, or would that be too creepy for you?
Okay, I'll start. I would say the problem is you chose Hollywood as a place, or Brentwood, wherever that is, where every place is going to have some horrific but fascinating story, and where that's kind of that kind of here is, and guess what else happened here? Any other town, I'd be like, I don't know about that.
Really? Okay, so let's say let's
ask you the resale value. It's that, would you do this? I may not have a problem with that, but will I have a problem trying to sell it to the next person?
Okay, so this is a real life example. Down the street from a place where we used to live, there was a house that was being used to manufacture meth. There was a ATF invasion. Kicking in the door, a raid, and a containable fire, but then they got out. So basically,
why aren't you and Jason Murphy hanging with those people, man? You guys could have had some great episodes.
Give us time. Give us time. We're going to make all this happen. A place like that, that has a very specific story around it, like all the neighbors were there for that day. It's their own miniature 9/11. They all remember like the day that the cops and everything was weird and scary and there was a fire that got put out. Would you buy that place? And where is your headspace in rehabilitating its image in your own mind?
I don't know where this is a thing for you. Like, if I were to buy that house where the ATF raided it for meth, I would buy it happily, and then I would put a gigantic file photo of the raid right in the foyer. Like, that is character, right? If you like the house, I guess I would not go so far as to say that I would be a tourist for something like this. I don't know if I would intentionally look for something that had a colorful, dark, or violent history to it. But if there was the option to, like, get it maybe even a little cheaper because it's harder for people to sell and some people have an issue about it, I would jump on something like that. If there were someplace in Oakland, all right, this is going to get dark. If there were places in Oakland that had, let's say, theoretically just suffered tremendous fire damage, and I had a chance to buy it and rehab it into an actual house, I would do it.
Shaking my head. Well, I for me, it's not so much a matter of, like, my personal preference. More comes down to, like, well, would I be able to sell it later? You know, it's that. I mean, I may not have a problem with it, but
you very quickly pivoted from shaking my head in disapproval of Justin's ghoulish behavior and immediately went Gordon Gekko and be like, question is, can you make a buck from it? See, now you're talking my language.
Yeah, I'm not so-and-so over here following the fire trucks around ready to go make offers, you know, to homeowners right after the point of devastation.
I'm saying if it got me a little deal, if it's a little bit of a, you know, if I can afford to buy a house in Oakland, which I can't currently because of some bizarre thing that happened, I would take advantage of that.
Here's Justin putting a blanket around a fire survivor. And are you okay? Here's some coffee. No. Right now, there's a lot of damage, so the assessment on this isn't that high, but I'm willing to forgive some of that and make you a good deal. I can do cash. Okay. We can do cash.
All right. Although, another great companion show for our morbid Death Hunters version of HGTV television is there's the rehab, and then there's the buying. Negotiating with recent victims for their property.
You know, you walk in, there's blood on the walls, blood on the things like that. You know, you just I'm like, you know, they'll clean it up, but they can never really clean it up.
Okay, so let's flip it on the other side. Let's say the age of the tragedy, you know, time heals on all wounds. You know, it's kind of aged a little bit. And this, for all I know, may be a real thing. Let's say, like, the David Koresh Waco compound goes for sale. That entire acreage, and it's you have a need for a little bit of warehouse space, and it's available. Does knowing its pedigree increase or decrease your interest in buying it?
All right. Real talk, if you had an awesome lineup for a music festival on the David Koresh compound, it would be a ballin' music festival.
But
Bryce is of the age. Bryce?
Sure.
You live within driving distance of Waco, Texas. If there was a rad lineup, just pick any of the festival lineups that are happening right now.
Sure. Chainsmokers, Muse, the others.
Yeah, what other bands do you know, Bryce?
I could Google real fast.
I do love the music festival solely programmed by Brian trying to remember bands. Like, it's yes. Chainsmokers, Muse, Smash Mouth,
Kid Rock.
We've been trying to find Antarctic Monkeys.
Come on. A music festival on the Koresh compound in Waco, you're going to that, right?
Yeah, probably.
Of course you're going to that.
Yeah. Especially if it's like a weekend, like camp. Like, I don't think I would probably want to go to a camping sort of festival, but if it was like, that would be interesting. That would be an interesting proposition of spending a weekend there.
I mean, listen, I feel like we are in the sweet spot for the Koresh, for the Koresh compound, because it's long enough ago that it's been kind of forgotten, right? Like, it's not necessarily fresh, but it's still dangerous enough that, like, oh, cults and guns and federal overreach, all the things the kids are into.
Yeah. Well, I like to think of, like, okay, how far away was something from another thing? So Waco was, what, 93? Yep. Okay, so let's look at Jonestown was 78. So it was only 15 years after.
So it's longer. Like, Waco is older than Jonestown was when Waco happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? 9/11 is older than Jonestown was when Waco happened.
Waco happened, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyhow, gentlemen, let's change the topic. I've got more ghost stuff. That was enough for you? You want another ghost thing?
No, I got another. Ghost me up. I'm not scared enough because the answer is I'm going to buy all this property and I'm going to kind of
read. All right, hold it. Brian, hold it. You don't know what's about to happen here, okay? Okay, I'm going to buy this property. Yeah, well, it's this place on Malta and we found a bunch of ash and Nazi helmets in a rectangular thing. It's a little thing called Raiders of the Lost Ark happened there.
Yeah. No, totally. Wait, what? Don't open your eyes.
You know, the whole Ark thing, would you buy that? You know, buy that plot, you know?
Yeah, of course all I right. would.
Fine. I'm ready. You ready? This is now. Now you guys, now it's coming, all right? Because you're like, all oh right. yeah. It's just because we're talking about a murder. We're talking about ghosts. We're talking about ghosts and stuff, okay? Oh, I'm not afraid of like, you know, little ghosts to just write something in the dust because it's probably a contractor. I'm just going to fire him anyways. It's what I do because I'm a greedy capitalist, doesn't care about ghosts and stuff. What about a haunted woods? Woods that are haunted with may have been a girl that was murdered by a train. And apparently,
murdered by a train? Is that the legal definition?
Brian. And the ghost
was the train.
It's ghostology, Brian. That's a thing that happens, okay?
Okay.
Now, she haunts the woods, Brian. She lurks through the woods. Paranormal investigators have dug into this and found out they think she may have been murdered. And you're like, I don't believe in ghosts. What if I showed you a photo of this girl? What if I showed you a photo of a girl captured on a wildlife camera, this ghost wandering aimlessly through the woods, haunting, waiting for the next person to possess, to make them do weird things?
Man,
can you handle this? I'm going to show you actual ghost footage.
She's walking through the woods, creepily singing Drops of Jupiter.
It's a picture in the woods in Washington County that sparked hundreds of comments and shares on social media. Some say it could be a supernatural photo. So we spoke with a paranormal expert to see what she thinks. The mystery of spooky things in the woods has attracted generations of intrigue. Now, locally,
keep going. No, we got to hear. Wait, got to go back to the forest. The expert.
This blurry photo of a little girl deep in the woods near Center Cambridge has the whole town talking.
We like to look at the actual footage from the actual camera it came from. There's just a lot of historical places, and we do pick up a lot of stuff from that.
Tanya Woodward is president of the Greenwich Paranormal Research Team. She says the image, which was taken from a trail camera off Route 74, doesn't provide a lot of information for her to read.
Trail cams don't take the best pictures. It's tough.
She said she would like permission to visit the property with her team to determine if there's any possible paranormal activity or to see if this is a real child captured by the trail camera. She says she has a lot of questions for the property owner, who at this point wants to remain private.
What neighborhood kids are around? Do they have kids? What time of day it was set up, where it was set up, can we look through it to see, take the path and see where it was?
She says with all the history in the area, paranormal activity is common.
We've experienced a lot. We've been to a lot of places, especially out north.
Police say since the story broke, they've gotten countless calls and emails about the photo, several suggesting that legend has it a little girl was hit and killed on the train tracks that used to run through the area. So we asked Woodward.
Why do you think there's so much interest?
I think a lot of people are getting more and more interested because a lot of people have had experiences and now are finally coming out because of all the TV shows everyone sees.
So whether this is actual paranormal activity, some Photoshop trickery, or an actual child playing in the woods, you can depend on us to stay on top of this story and get to the bottom of it. In Washington County, Noelle McLaren, News 10, ABC.
I mean, the most gratuitous part of that whole experience is the fact that, they turn it into an ad for themselves. Wait, did they fade her out at the end? Did she vanish?
They did fade her out. They faded her out at the end, so it looked like she was indeed a ghost. So where do we start? There's a trail cam of a girl, allegedly.
Let's start with there's a trail cam, which by definition means it takes pictures every time anything moves anywhere over extremely long periods of time. Also, it's placed in the woods, a.k.a. common area, where anything from elk to deer to moose to, oh, I don't know, maybe a human being might be thought to walk by.
See, what I think this is just lazy on so many levels, because like they don't even show a picture or like a drawing of the girl who got hit by the train, allegedly. Right. Like, it, like that's what you want. You want the like and she looks like old Annabelle Malie, who got hit by the train and died. What on these parts?
So, okay, that's actually a really good point. So it's like, it's as though there's a phase. So you start with an artifact that has to be curious in some way. Then you have to kind of cast about searching for a narrative. Now, you can't do actual investigations, because actual investigations would be, you know, spend resources to reach out like, hi, here's a picture of a girl. Like cut out the what looks like a translucent body and instead just show the picture of the face of the girl. Reach out to the 1,000 people who live closest and say, do you know this person? Do you know this person? Do you know this person? And then eventually you get somebody like, yeah, no, that's Susie. She lives down the way. But you don't want that, because what you want to do is manufacture a mystery. So instead what you do is you have this mysterious photo, and then you search. You don't show the photo, but instead ask around for legends of a girl who got killed in the area. Is there any reason a ghost girl would be in this area? And you keep asking that until you get an answer that's pretty close. Like, well, a ghost girl got run over by a train once. And if you listen real close, you'll hear her mom telling her not to go play on the tracks.
I would be 0% shocked if this was the paranormal investigator pitching this entire story to the news station and the reporter, because like everything else, it like there's, where does this come from? Is it like, you know, ghost pictures are us dot Michigan or wherever the hell these people are? Like,
well, I want to give you a, if you do a search right now for this, like ghost picture, whatever, you're going to get on a Google search, ghost picture of young girl in the woods has upstate New York town buzzing about paranormal, creepy pic of ghost girl freaks out small town, Nate, May 5th. Cambridge ghost sighting, photo mysterious girl in New York town sparks debate, May 3rd. Case of mysterious, ghost girl. Okay, you have like tons of stuff from May 4th and May 5th, right? Tons of stuff from May 4th and May 5th about this, right? On May 2nd was when the story broke. It was the May 2nd when the story broke. On May 3rd. 2 days before many of these stories have come out talking about how spooky this is, right? Oh, and these are major outlets too, like New York Post and other places like this, major outlets that cover this sort of stuff, blogs and whatever. So it's not just one little crazy blog ran with this thing. So like, let me give an example of, you know, so May 4th, USA Today. USA Today has this article on May 4th, okay? ABC News, May 4th, has this article, okay? On May 3rd, a day before all those came out, Cambridge police chief said Wednesday that he heard from a person who believes his granddaughter's a girl in the picture and said they remembered a camera taking their picture and they went for a walk in the wooded area in question. This was solved before those stories were even written, but they didn't care. They didn't bother. And you know, we talk about the age era of fake news, things like that. It's little things like this where it's okay to say, oh, well, we'll leave that part out. What are we don't bother to search? And like, you know, I know, hey, it's just a fun sort of story, but there are people that believe this thing is true and they will go see there's all these stories about this, and the reporters and the people who did this, USA Today, you know, ABC News. Okay. And again, like, well, it's an affiliate. It's this, it's their brand. It's their domain name. They're the ones who are repeating this sort of stuff. They're not choosing to show you or do the research on it to find out. No, yeah, it's, you know, it's a little girl and her grandfather walking through the woods.
Man, so
by and large, the way that these things happen is they get put up on wire services that go to all these like news media outlets, and it is their prerogative to either run the wire story or use the wire story and do their own original reporting on top of it to put it out there. Usually that would require maybe a little Google foo to see if there's any new developments on something like that. Obviously not used here. But that is amazing. That within a day, this grandpa's like, oh no, that's Sadie. She was walking by there, said she thinks she saw a camera.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like there's perverse incentives where it's like if you want to spin something that might turn into a tweet storm, you know, firestorm of clicks and ability to generate ads, then the last thing you do is jump to the logical conclusion. Instead, what you do is you shine a bright light on the darkest, most obscure part of the story and say, like, doesn't this look like a mystery? And I don't know. It's I'm going through a really weird place psychologically with the idea of the way that we consume in the moment media like this. And I'm not saying that, like, I think we've been pretty fair on this show about making it clear that we're playing a game about playing what if, but I feel like a lot of news outlets realize there's more power and more clicks and more popularity if they leave out the what if part and instead, you know, just portray two sides of the gap and say, who knows what the truth is?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the artificial idea that I used to drive me nuts that we would, when I worked for the James Randi Foundation, you know, paranormal investigating, we'd get a reporter in there and be like, oh, so what are you doing? You know, what's your angle? We like to present both sides of the story. And I'd be like, what is that? So this person claims they're a ghost. And we're saying, well, let's look at the evidence. And that you think that that's a side, like, are you against the side of what's the evidence to support this? Is that an equally valid position to, hey, these things are real, we don't need to question them? I said, our position is, let's ask more questions. Let's look at this. And you're saying that's an opinion. I said, you know, you're presenting it like we're saying that it's not real. We're like, no, we're saying, go look at this, go look at that. We're not the ones making the claim. We're saying, let's just evaluate that claim and have this false dichotomy. It drove me nuts. It's one thing to say, it's this, it's no, it's not. We're like, no, let's go ask. There's a process. Should we do the process? So you're either, and I Troy, so you're saying there's either rationality, which is what we recommend, or irrationality. That's the side. And you're going to give both sides here why we should be rational about it. And this is why we should be irrational about it. This is why we should be scientific. And now I'm going to give the opposite point why we should be anti-scientific about that. And it just, they didn't like that because they didn't want to do any research. That was a funny topic to talk about or whatever. It was amusing to them. And it's like, all right, well, you're part of the problem. Part of the problem.
Yeah. And I don't know. Maybe this is a moment of self-reflection where it's like, I want to say, like, we are three guys who, as we've often said, don't believe in Sasquatch, but think he's awesome. We clearly love the titillation, that electric tickle that comes from walking right up to the edge of mystery and asking what if. And in the right circumstances, the right ghost story can really be inspiring and create an amazing experience for us. But there's something to me I didn't mind it when That's Incredible did it as a kid, because That's Incredible did not pretend to be a news program, right? They told amazing stories, right? And in that regard, like, I want to follow in that vein and tell amazing stories, whether or not they're true. But then when you mix in the same people, that same news station is going to turn around and talk about the president's policy and whether or not this person should get the death sentence. That really messes me up.
I got two anecdotes for you. One, a friend of ours, Justin and I, back in Florida, Jack Latona, who was really involved in politics, really one of the smartest people I know. Jack talked about, he gets a call because they asked about some city vote about some city commissioner. And he said, well, she didn't vote for that. You know, she voted against it, whatever. And well, she says she voted for it. And so I'm going to run with that. Jack's like, no, she didn't. And then she's like, well, you know, I'm going to put that as your opinion. Jack's like, you can go down to the city. You can pull the record of the vote. It doesn't need to be my opinion or I said this is what happened, you know. Yeah. And it's like, but, you know, it's Lynn Porter's got so much to do. But it's like, yeah, it's easier to write. It's his opinion. Like, yeah, there's a fact. You can get a fact. That fact's attainable. And guess what? And the fact that what's really cool is that somebody's lying. You know, you can either find out that he's lying or she's lying and have yourself a real story. But if you like that other person, you don't want to reveal the fact that she's lying, then yeah, and that's your bias. Your bias is you don't want to call that other commissioner a liar. So you're just going to say the other one said this and it's a he said, she said. I'm not going to look at the facts. La, 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 la. I see nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I don't know that we can get into kind of the mechanics of access journalism. And, you know, of course, you don't want to piss off the person who's sitting in power because they're the person that's going to give you all the information about everything else around it. So, yeah, it's a super weird situation. But in general, and this is something that being close to journalism taught me, is always take a closer look at what you are consuming and understand humans, lazy humans, oftentimes make it and not these like sent from above truth robots.
You know, sitting in the newsroom, like, we got to get all the facts where we run. They're not some lazy.
We need facts. Go get more facts for the news.
I got one more thing to point out, too, is between the three of us, I don't think any one of us are people to really offer hot, quick takes on breaking stories or news when the facts are still not there. You know, first 24 hours, usually things are all wrong and we don't know anything. And we live in a culture where people, as soon as there's a police shooting or political thing, people are just so eager, like, oh, my God, outrage, outrage. It's like you're hearing the first person to scream about what happened there. And you're getting a very, very biased point of view, which may be accurate or maybe not. But the number of times people just fly off the handle and overreact on this stuff, and celebrities and stuff, be clown themselves doing this all the time. But the three of us aren't people like that. I don't think that's really ever been our brand, is we're going to be the first ones to tell people how outraged or how stupid something is.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not what we're aiming for. I'm not going to claim we have a perfect track record in that regard. But this ties into those of you guys who listen to both programs. There was a recent talk on Night Attack where we talk about outrage culture and about the fact that there's a whole strata of content creators that make money, whether you love or hate a thing. What they want to do is find the thing that causes you to read the most on it and click the most on relevant advertisements or other stories or whatever. I wonder if we're reaching an age where humanity as a society is losing its taste for that, or at least acknowledging that that's not a great situation we're in.
What's frustrating to me in this whole fake news, this whole thing, just debate and all that, and the thing that drives me crazy, and that having been involved in critical thinking education for years, we all have, you know, the three of us, that's the thing that unites us, is we've all came together because, you know, we're more about how you evaluate information and not your set of facts. And that's the problem I get into a lot, where I get into people who think they're scientific, but they're into scientism or science is a dogma. It's like, science is not this body of knowledge. That is not what science is. It's a process. It is a process. And you can take that information that came from that process, and that's great. But that's not what that's not the science. The science is how you get this. So when you say, I'm not going to use this process for evaluating information or doing that, like fake news. Well, if you're a critical thinker, then you understand how to evaluate this stuff and say, okay, I'm never going to have 100% certainty. I'm never going to have this. I will conditionally accept this because the sources are reliable, but I'm not going to say that this is definite or make any determinate long-term decisions or embarrass myself over this sort of thing, because you have to evaluate these things. But that's a thing that's been lost, is that, well, no, this source is legitimate. No, all human sources are suspect. All are suspect. You Correct. Need to have a process to evaluate it and to say, because I trust this source, I'm going to fly off on the handle right now and say this is an outrage. No, that's not right.
So we're not quite to picks yet, but I'm going to preemptively make my pick. I tweeted it out last night. There's a random thread on Reddit where it's opinion analysis over a Huffington Post post. Somebody said, Neil deGrasse Tyson says, science deniers in power are a profound threat to democracy, period. Quote, you don't have the option to say you don't believe in E equals MC squared. It's true whether you believe it or not, right? And there was a fantastic response from a guy, molecular bio guy, who goes on to explain, like, no, Tyson states that E equals MC squared is true, but science cannot prove that it is. Absolutely cannot. Rather, and this is me quoting, after a century of trying, gathering as much data as we can and testing it in every known way, we have failed to reject the possibility
exactly.
that E equals MC squared. And he goes on, it's a fantastic essay. I highly recommend it. Basically, what he ends up stating or restating is Karl Popper's theory that that truth lies not in, you know, 1,000 pieces of evidence for a thing is insignificant to one piece disproving a thing. What you want to do, if your theory is unfalsifiable, it's not a theory, right? And so at any rate, it's very, very well stated here, and I really dig it, and I'll Excellent. Figure out a simple bit.ly for that for everyone to read.
I got, you know, I'm going to go say climate change, say the words. I got frustrated where, again, I'm a believer that I think CO2 CO2 is a greenhouse gas. I think that producing a X amount of that can increase the absorption rate of heat in our atmosphere. No issue with that. Feedback cycles, things like that, are far more complex than myself or really most people can comprehend, and our ability to predict those are improving, but it's a complicated issue, right? But I am not putting that CO2 out there. That's not going to be a problem. I don't believe that at all. I think that it gets to be a bigger, complex question, what we need to do, et cetera, all that. The problem is that, like, I've noticed the people who are, hey, we need to do this right now, we need to do this, whatever. Why? Well, the authority, they use the same arguments that I dealt with from creationists back when I worked in the skeptical world. They give me the same arguments from authority, the same arguments from the majority, the same arguments from that I'm like, no, that's not science. And that's what drives me crazy. Like, well, there's a consensus says, the Bible says it's this. That's not how we arrive at truth.
Well, and in that specific instance, and we've talked about this before, I think that there's a I don't know if you've heard the Radio Labs or whatever, where they've talked about, like, previous to there being a word for different specific colors, it's very difficult for people to distinguish between things, right? Mm-hmm. We don't yet have a word in the common vernacular between analysis and prescription. The analysis can be, yes, it's getting warmer. Yes, it's because of CO2. Yes, it's because of humanity's carbon emissions. But unfortunately, in the vernacular, in the universally, everyone's like, well, that means that the solution has to be cut back on these things. Whereas I would like to think more expansive minds could look, and let's call it cancer, right? The globe has cancer. Cancer doesn't mean, why don't you try not getting cancer? Cancer means, what can we do about the cancer? And whether, you know, if the problem is that the globe is heating up 2 degrees, there's a lot of clever ways we could talk about not raising 2 degrees.
100% agree. Yes, and. And that is the problem, is that we need to silo the people who are, you know, silo, hey, this is what we're realizing, what's happening, from the advocacy, and therefore we need this. Because the problem is the people that, some of the people pushing for, therefore we need to do this, they want to do that anyways. They want to deindustrialize. Some of them, not all, want to deindustrialize and want to do that. And their reasons for wanting to do it are across the board, but they can use any opportunity to say that. But if, like, hey, no, you know what? We've all of a sudden got solar power. We've solved the CO2 thing. They're still not going to want to stop the deindustrialization and stop trying to move that. So the facts are irrelevant to some parts of the people. Some people, that is irrelevant. And in many movements, as you know, it's, and I'll get into my pick later on, which is the Attention Emergence by Timothy Wu, which is an excellent book. You know, when you want to have a movement, I don't want you to think about the facts. I don't want you to pick these apart. I don't want to give you opposing points of view. I want you to be on board with me, because if you have those things, you might all of a sudden waver, and then I don't have you 100% into this. So it's not in my interest to let you arrive at this from an emotion, from a rational, logical point of view. I want you to come at it purely emotional. So that's why I'm not going to point out the flaws in our arguments. I'm not going to be logical about it, because, well, I might lose you. So it's greater to me to...
What? In stark relief to those enemies of rationality that just want to dazzle you with stuff so they can achieve their own ends, we do not put up with that at patreon.com/weirdthings.
Specifically, we have a longstanding philosophy here. If you're listening to Weird Things and you believe that global warming can only be solved by reducing carbon emissions, we say pledge $1. If you believe that global warming is definitely a catastrophe, but a more clever solution is right around the corner, then donate $2 per episode.
Yeah.
Choice is yours, guys. Choice is yours.
So go ahead and check it out. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Not only do you get early access, separate RSS feed for... After Things, our show after weird things, but also so much more.
Which, by the way, I don't know that we've taken a moment to pause and talk about this live on the stream. There's a considerable chunk of our audience that values the honesty and the candor that we express during after things. After things is when we talk about the real numbers, the real difficulty, the real life decisions that come into being an independent creator of whatever stripe. There are some people who feel like After Things is the real gem and that they just tolerate weird things to get to After Things. Yeah. And you know what? To each their own.
Any way you want it. That's the way you need it.
Yeah. Exactly. I hear that a lot, that's the real, I've had some very, very complimentary things said about After Things.
Check it out if you haven't already. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
And don't forget.
All right, guys. I'm going to dive into one more. Oh, Bryce.
Don't forget, if we hit $600, we're unlocking the Journey Saga, which is an RSS feed.
Oh, that's right. We're going to cut out all of the Journey Quest and arrange it all in order. And for any of the parts that don't make sense, we're going to put in little interstitials where a narrator will smooth over the edges. We're going to have like a coherent, cogent, 100-hour audiobook?
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's the abridged version. Gentlemen, I've got one more thing. The trailer dropped today. A trailer that's a sequel to a movie that's like 35 years old.
Mm.
Did you see the Blade Runner 2049 trailer?
I did. I saw it live. Do you know about this, Andrew? Do you know that I went to IMAX HQ and I saw I was there with Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford and the director of Arrival, also the director of Blade Runner 2049?
Do you know, I said to them, the people who organized that, I said, thanks for inviting me, but I'm not getting up at 8 a.m. and play a Vista to go watch a trailer.
Yeah, well... for me, it was super novel just that I happened to be in the area. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'll totally go do it. Also, I periscoped the whole Q&A, not knowing whether or not that was allowed or not. So yeah. You can check that on my feed. But on the one hand, it is a carefully crafted experience for everybody involved, right? On the other hand, it was friggin' dope to be there for the reveal of that stuff. You watched the trailer, Andrew. What did you think?
I'm listen, man. I they asked me if I wanted to go do that, and I'm like, because they're like, we have an event. It's Warner Brothers. I'm like, please don't be Wonder Woman. And I'm like. And like, it's Blade Runner. I'm like, yes. And I'm like, oh, girl, this would be great. And then I look and I realize that it's just the trailer and the interviews. I'm like, are the writers going to, is Hampton Fancher going to be there? Michael Green? I'm like, no. I'm like, the writers aren't there. I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a pass on this one, guys. Take a pass on this one. But anyhow, I Denis Villeneuve, he did Sicario. He did Arrival. He did, what was it? The other one, first one I always freak, which I have not seen. He's a fantastic director. I thought Sicario and Arrival are amazing films, and I'm excited that he's doing Blade Runner. I'm excited he's going to try to do Dune. This looks beautiful, but you know, what will it be when it comes? You know, what will be to be the experience? I don't know, but the look is great, and also I just love the fact. And that was my thing that people were against a bit, like, you know, AI is like a really interesting topic right now, and be kind of cool to have the writers there. But anyhow, I think that. It's very topical. The reason I brought that up is that, you know, when that movie came out in 1982, it's like, yeah, maybe robots, but they're kind of like really like fleshy clones, which is sort of the thing I loved. It's like, yeah, we'll call them robots, but they're kind of people. In this day and age, when, you know, we talk to virtual assistants on a regular basis, you're talking to Siri, you're talking to Alexa, you got Cortana, you know, whatever, when these things have become an integrated part and we know these things are getting better incrementally than leaps, robot cars are a thing that are just a couple years from just being able to fall asleep behind the wheel and end up in LA if you start in New York. That's a thing. That's not a thing like, in 40 years. Like, no, 2020, we're going to have, that's going to be a reality, all this stuff. So my question is, you know, what's going to happen when we get these robots that are walking around and talking and stuff like this, and they feel separate from the cloud or whatever, and they do that? are we going to accept these things? I think we're going to be super hostile. I'm going to be super hostile.
Yeah. Well,
depends. It depends on what they get popular for within our culture, right? And whether or not we feel threatened by them. I guess that is inevitable, but you know, I think that's where the resentment comes in from feeling threatened that you are going to be replaced.
I was just going to say, like, not for nothing. This is territory humanity has explored before, and in the southern United States, the way that they justified, you know, using other humans as slave labor is that they dehumanized them. They did what they told themselves, whatever story they need to make them feel okay about driving them like machines. But moving forward, we have the weird, strange, perverse counter incentive of like, they're actually machines and they can actually feel or not feel as much as the programmers of them decide that they should or should not feel. For example, you know, if you watch Rick and Morty, the Mr. Meeseeks box is a counterintuitive shell in that it will do what it wants. All it wants to do is complete your task. And what it craves the most is the sweet release of death upon completing the task. Would it be immoral to create such a creature? Of course, the problem in Blade Runner is that the replicants want to live beyond their targeted 4 years, and they that's why they go rogue. But if built into their DNA was like, all I want to do is not exist after my task has been completed, would that be a bad thing? Like, that's kind of a heavy philosophical concept.
I don't know. Two, the question comes into place, what happens when it says that's not what I want to do? I'm going to give you an example take the family dog. Okay, this is an animal that we've conditioned. We took the wolf. We took these little wolves and like, hey, we're going to take you in. We're going to make you part of our family. We're going to condition you to love us unconditionally, to accept us as part of the pack, to accept us as the leader, to warn us, to be part of us, all this. This is the purpose you're going to serve, right? And dogs are like, all right, sounds great. This is great. You're awesome. You're great. Thanks for doing this. And over time, they become extremely dependent upon us. They like us. But then, you know, sometimes dogs are dogs and they bite people. Sometimes dogs are dogs and they go do dog-like things. And then we're like, well, got to kill that dog. Because we programmed you to do a thing, you're not doing the thing, and then that's the thing danger. What happens when it doesn't want to do the thing? What happens when it wants to change its programming? What's when it's like, yeah, Brian, you know, I know I'm supposed to, I'm your sex bot, but yeah, that's
I'll
the question.
Run for president.
That's the question. Is it's not? It's when it's behaving and doing the thing that it's supposed to do, then we say it's a machine. But when it starts to say, I'm not happy about this, I'm not comfortable with this.
Yeah. So let's try the other side of that discussion. And this is something recently I listened to on Sam Harris's podcast. They talked about the philosophical question of if a human being can be convinced by another human being and change their mind. Like if there is an argument so good that it causes someone else to change their mind, is it moral to, without their permission, tell them this story in such a way that it causes them to change their core beliefs?
Likewise, is it fact-based?
Let's say it totally is. Let's say, okay. But again, it's one of those things. Let's say it's that middle ground. Let's say it's something philosophical or spiritual, right? Let's posit that there exists an argument that you know always works 100% of the time, and you know that the moment you spend this 45 minutes, that other person will be, some might call it corrupted, some might call it corrected. What is your moral responsibility to do or not do those things?
I'll let Justin go first because I keep responding.
I don't really feel like I understand the question.
All right. So the idea is if you knew you had the magic argument or the magic persuasion that you could use on somebody and you're going to win them over with this magic persuasion technique, and it maybe even works in ways they don't even realize, but yeah, you have it. And let's just say that it's fact-based. It's not like the persuasion is there may be a bomb in your house and you got to do what I say. The magic persuasion thing. My argument was I have no problem with that because I believe in agency, or at least I believe believing in the illusion of agency is paramount to me. I believe in free will. I believe in the idea of free will, or the notion of free will, that I believe that we're discrete. Where we draw the circle around that, whatever, is up for debate for sure. But I do not think we're mindless automatons. I don't think that we are these mindless sort of robots. And because for me, a lot of things fall apart once you accept that. So the idea that I can't give you this information because you're going to lose control and I'm going to corrupt your hard drive and all of a sudden hack your system with this. Then I don't think you're really experiencing, using legitimate information, then I don't think you're really experiencing full agency. So
that does work on a person by person basis, but on a society level basis, and we just saw an attempt in this regard with the French elections, it certainly worked. Like it definitely had a measurable impact on the United States elections. That there was a giant email dump, hacking dump, WikiLeaks, whatever, shortly before the election. And in an alternate universe, I think you could make a very strong case that the president would be very different, would be elected differently had that not happened. And then we saw the same thing attempted, or what appears to be attempted, in France, but it was attempted on a culture that had already been kind of tipped off to that methodology in there. So like in that regard, is that moral or immoral, knowing that you can dump a bunch of, whether it's information or disinformation or noise or whatever, and know that a significant number of populace, not everyone obviously because everybody has agency, but some number of people will suddenly get clouded and not participate in the way they would have just 24 hours prior.
I think it's immoral for me to prejudge how other people are going to handle information that I give them that is factual. I think it's immoral for me to make assumptions, to say I'm not going to give this to them because I don't think they have the agency like I do to handle this. I think that's denying other people agency, which is moral.
It is certainly immoral if, the access to the emails was obtained through devious means, right? Through illegal means. That is immoral. The idea of the information being dumped out there, like if you just got that information and your job is to be a clearinghouse for these things like WikiLeaks is, then you can understand. Very, very little high value information makes its way out into the public square without there being a point to being why it's out there. And that's not just in politics. That's in business and smaller levels of government and sports, like everything that comes from behind the curtain into the public square is there because somebody wants it to be there. And, that is a regular element of our society.
Sure. I guess what I'm asking is, and again, everything in the ethereal, everything in the theoretical here, you have some controversial information and it's your decision to release it in this exact time window because you know that in this time window, no matter whether it's true or not true, whether it matters or doesn't matter, you actually know that psychologically speaking, study after study has shown that there will be a 48-hour period of reactionism and you have the opportunity to press that button. I mean, would that not be a form of mind control to create a certain output at some point, assuming you're the one who presses send at that very particular time?
Well, mind control is a very loaded word. If I say I mind influence. Do I know? And again, assuming that I don't know the veracity of it, but I know that if I know that it's not, then I'm intentionally I'm trying to give people false.
Sure.
So let's assume that I to my knowledge, the veracity of it's true. Do I release this? Again, I am not in the ability. I don't believe it's my responsibility or even I don't think it's morally right for me to shepherd, to be the gatekeeper for other people when it comes to try to decide what they can and cannot handle. There are cases where, that's been advantageous. Times of war, you want to hold back certain things. You don't want to release certain things. And I will say, there are a lot of cases where it's advantageous to do that. But in the long run, because I believe in the flow of information, I believe in information systems, I believe in markets, I believe in evolution, I believe in a lot of these things and all tie back together. Gatekeeping information in the long run is bad. It prevents information flow because the gatekeeper then is trying to figure out when they're going to do it, when they're not. And they don't know. They don't have the wisdom of the crowds. They don't have market theory. They don't have these things leading to figure out what is the right thing or not to do it. And yeah, I could say here it was right. Yep. But 99% of the times, we see that a lot where we find out things were withheld that we go, wait a second, we knew this? And like, yeah, but we didn't want to unduly affect this. But oh my God, things could have happened. You know, 9/11 could have been averted because one party had information that they didn't want to prejudice the other party with or whatever. And it's like, huh. So that outcome was good. And we can say there are situations where it was. And my argument is like, if I believe that people have agency and free will, or, you know, if I believe that your free will is as valid as my free will, if I believe my illusion is as valid as your illusion, then I have no business censoring the information you get.
That works.
No. But I will say, you know, this is a very interesting, a Peter Thiel quote, or, you know, the thing, not a quote, but a thing he's talked about, which isn't original to him, but is he's made this controversial statement you have to think about. He says that is democracy and freedom incompatible? Because when you have a democracy, you always have the ability to vote away the rights of other people.
Right. That's the old quote. Democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Getting back into the whole, the gatekeeper sort of mentality. So,
hey man, I'm done with 21st century politics. I want to go back to a simpler time. I don't know, some simpler time when 20th century, like Hitler.
Yeah. Nothing simpler than that.
No.
So we've got a Journey Quest. Do we have a recap? Do we have a little recap on Journey Quest?
Previously on
Journey Quest!
The zombie survival guide suggested that you should ride a bike because it's quiet, maneuverable.
First thing I did when I came back in time is I killed Boris.
We can't solve every problem with killing the sovereign.
Hey, Winston Churchill's coming in here.
Wait, you're friends with Winston Churchill?
But you'll never guess who he actually is. So, I like that I'm dressed exactly the same.
Definitely caught that. Definitely saw that.
Yeah, these previously ons are going to give Andrew a complex about his wardrobe.
No, last time I was wearing a SpaceX shirt, and I'm wearing my Project Lightsail shirt. They're both very dark blue and look very same underneath my sweater, but it's totally different, guys.
It's fine. Look, the important thing is that Justin and I appear to have traveled through time and space and found ourselves in a bunker with what looked like Eva Braun and Hitler, only it sounds an awful lot like Hitler is being portrayed by Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, in his greatest role yet, it is Matthew McConaughey as Hitler. He is from an alternate timeline where Matthew McConaughey is one of the world's greatest scientists. He discovered time travel. He came back in time so he could kill the Hitler of his timeline unwittingly, becoming the Hitler of our timeline.
Yeah, his Hitler in his timeline is a guy named Boris.
That's right.
A Russian tyrant.
That's right. And does have we established whether or not Matthew McConaughey realizes what a mistake he's made in our timeline by being Hitler?
I don't know if it's a mistake or not. I don't know, Brian. I think you're sort of judging things. And
so we found out that that part of the time travel is something that needs to be medically induced, and he does so by smoking his own strain of sticky weed that keeps him in his time locked position as Hitler. But now we found out that there's another time traveler that is portraying Winston Churchill, which opens up all sorts of questions, and that brings us to now.
So right now, you guys are there. He's all right, guys, so that's the deal. I killed Boris, and you guys have been questioning about the ethics of the Third Reich. And he says, listen, I'm not a politics guy. I'm not into that kind of thing. Yeah. You know, it's like, I got approached a long time ago by his director, Linklater or whatever, about playing a part in a movie, and said, you know, sounds kind of interesting, but I think I'm going to go do my own thing because I don't want to get into influence and politics, entertainment. But now I find myself in politics. But anyhow, that's neither here nor here. I've got a couple other buddies that are time travelers here that I think people I'd like you to meet. And Mr. Winston Churchill's about to show up, and then Lynn's going to show up a little bit later. So
wait, who's gonna show up a little bit later?
Lennon. This guy named Lennon. Have you ever heard of Lennon?
Sure. Hey, yeah. Listen. Real quick, Mr. Hitler / McConaughey. Number one, loved you in Dazed and Confused, one of your best works. Highly underappreciated.
He never made that, Brian. He never made Dazed and Confused.
Did he?
Yeah. No, I passed on that. That's what it was called. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in our timeline, you did a fantastic job of being. Did you know you won an Oscar in our timeline?
What?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Do you know what you said when you got the Oscar?
No.
You said, "Death to all Jews."
What? In Hollywood? I said that?
Okay, no, actually what you said was "all right, all right, all right." It was very beloved by everybody.
All right, all right, all right. That's a very interesting point of view. I'm going to listen, my friends are here, and we're going to plot because, you know, we're in a position now to you know, bring about a new world order and come to peace. And like, you know, Lenin's going to show up is great because, like, man, we was able to get some life-saving medical technology to help him kind of avoid the what happened to Lenin in my timeline, you know. So anyhow, point is we're going to have a little conversation. We're going to figure out next steps. Takes a big giant inhaling. And knock, knock, knock. Oh, as you have guessed, it's the gentleman from across the pond, and he's here to discuss this secret mission, yes?
Real quick, Dr. H, but before we let in Winston Churchill, how do you plan to explain who Justin and I are and why we're here? Should we adopt some kind of character here?
He's a time traveler, too, like you guys.
Got it. Okay.
It's Tom Traveler. Tom Traveler like you guys.
Excuse me, real quick. I have to go to the bathroom. I'm just going to go pee-pee in the potty. I'll be right back. Right? Right.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to go to the bathroom.
All right. Brian's walked to the bathroom.
Right. Okay. Your friend has a small bladder there.
No. He's a crazy guy, man. Always going to the bathroom. Old Bathroom Brian. That's what we call him.
I don't understand what's going on, but anyhow. Mr. Churchill's here. Hey, come on in there, Mr. Churchill.
Hi, it's me, Winston Churchill. I'm V for Victory. That's me. I'm Winston Churchill, ladies and gentlemen. Look at me, great leader, a man of all seasons. Winston Churchill.
Justin, you're looking at Churchill, and there's something familiar, and Churchill now looks at you and winks at you.
Wait, what the hell? Wait a minute. I'm Winston Churchill? I'm not just in this timeline. Jesus, this would be a lot easier to portray if I wasn't the only voice.
Well, you see, that's a surprise, boys. In my timeline, I'm friends with you all.
All right, I flush the toilet and I walk out with my hands. I only ran them under the water. I didn't actually finish wiping them, so I'm not going to shake anyone's hands. It's me, Brian Brushwood. Why are there two Justin Robert Youngs here in the room? I don't understand. Well,
that's amazing because he looks like Churchill. You can look at body posture and see another Justin.
Yeah, I'm not Justin. I'm Winston Churchill.
Wink. Okay, but this guy here, that's Justin.
Yeah, no, Brian, I'm Justin. I'm your friend. We have been on this adventure since the post-apocalyptic wasteland that we escaped from America. And me, I'm Winston Churchill, the great
smoking
leader.
Smoking the cigar that keeps me in this timeline from my future with a totally different Justin and a totally different Matthew McConaughey, who apparently in your timeline is an actor?
Oh, dude, the best actor. Man. Hey, Justin Robert Young, you saw Interstellar, right? That was pretty good, right?
Oh, man. He's been on a real heater since The Lincoln Lawyer. Lincoln Lawyer? That sounds like something that you'd have to get from America, not in England like me, Winston Churchill, would deal in. Yep.
Yeah, man, this is really weird. I'm looking at Hitler that's not Hitler. I'm looking at Churchill that's not Hitler.
Lenin's here. Lenin's here.
Oh, Lenin. Lenin showed up.
We're having a conclave with the leaders of the free and not so free world, guys, to plan it out. Conclave of time travelers who have now become Hitler, Lenin, and Churchill. And then Justin and Brian are chilling out. But the secret is, I, Hitler, am actually Matthew McConaughey. My buddy Winston Churchill here is alternate timeline Justin. And here's Vladimir Lenin.
Hey, boss, it's me, V.I. Lenin. What's going on? Listen, I aim to serve. I want to make you happy. I think you should be doing tricks at the bar and on the street. But more importantly, I feel like the proletariat is getting screwed by the capitalist pigs.
But he's really Brian, so it's all a ruse because he's got some plot that he's going to try to...
He looks like he. All right. First of all, this is me, Brian, talking. That looks an awful lot like me. I'm sorry. Hitler / Matthew McConaughey. Can you explain to me what's going on? I'm looking at world leaders, and I'm seeing a lot of different iterations of people that seem very familiar.
Hey, well, you better watch your disrespect. That's my friend.
That was all right. Let me explain it here. Let me put away my Reich not bongo drums.
Your Reich not bongo drums.
So in my timeline, as you guys are aware of, there are different timelines and different times. And there are people in my timeline. We've got people who do stuff and other stuff and things like that. Okay. And things are different. Some things are the same, you know. In my timeline, Taco Bell never got rid of Nachos Extreme. Just saying. Okay. In your timeline, things are a little bit different from what I hear. He didn't get it. But I know that Justin and Brian in my timeline, they were part of my experiment. They're on board to go back and to try to fix history to make things right. Because in my history, Boris was the worst person possible. Boris was the one that took power in Russia. But I was able to take care of that and also was able to get my friend Brian to go back in time to become Vladimir I. Lenin and actually give him some life-saving medical technology so he wasn't going to die prematurely. And this guy's Boris's predecessor, Stalin, never came to power. Meanwhile, Winston Churchill, who, you know, seemed like a pretty chill guy, pretty good guy in my timeline, Justin went back to become Winston Churchill because with him as Winston Churchill, we were able to bring the war to an end prematurely and go into the next phase of our plan, which is what we're talking about now, right now, what the three of us can go do. Of course, did I mention that Mussolini is over here? You may know him as Bryce. Say hello to everybody, Bryce. He's on the phone.
Yeah. Hey, hello, everybody. I'm Mussolini.
Yeah, but Bryce, it's actually Bryce.
No, it's
so me. Here we are, the leaders of the world getting together. Emperor Hirohito couldn't make it because Tom just could not catch a flight from Japan. But it's all here, guys. It's all here. We're here to plan the rest of the future, to plan the future and where we want to go.
Yes, and I'm totally comfortable with this, says Winston Churchill. We've avoided the world's greatest pitfalls, and now we will chart a bold new course.
Yeah, what was his name? A Boris-free planet.
Here's the thing, guys. Old time traveling Justin here. I would like to just point out that this all seems good for you guys, and I can understand where your timelines would necessitate that you've kind of won the war, as it were. But you got to understand, in the timeline that you're in now, that I come from, you guys are kind of the baddies. Like, things wind up going very, very poorly for you, and you are known universally as, like, the worst actors in the history of modern civilization.
Well, that's you don't need to go personal with this, all right?
Yeah,
you're doing a good job as being.
I'm just saying that what you're planning might not have the consequences. Hey, you shut up! I'm Winston Churchill. You're telling me that I have a really bad reputation? No. Ironically, Winston, you split off from all these dopes and you defeat them, and then you are known as a hero while they are the villains.
How very convenient that Justin is the one telling Justin that he's the good guy.
Listen, this is just history in my timeline. So I don't know, but maybe you guys will rewrite
history of my timeline. What is your plan?
Yeah, what is our plan?
Bruce, Bryce my plan is to finish this cigar.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, we got rid of Boris already, so the only thing left to do.
F Boris. FB. That's the most famous FB in history.
Right.
Yeah, and Lynn and Brian just went off to use the restroom again. So
he actually might be back in one minute.
Handle this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he needs to, it's the problem with the time connections is sometimes it comes in and out.
Hey, well, here it's me. I'm back. It's Lennon. Did you guys have any decisions you needed to make about the proletariat?
Well, Brian Lennon, who is secretly libertarian, but trying to institute his new world order through the permanent revolution.
The only way to give true freedom is by oppressive government. I've said this as long as you've known me. I'm Lennon Bryan.
So that was Bryce Alini, who's actually Mussolini Bryce, who was you're just talking to you before. And Emperor Hito Tom Merritt can't get on the phone right now. So what we need to do now is to figure out what we want to do going forwards, guys. What's our plan? You know, here we are. We're at the nadir of history, or maybe that's the word. I don't know. I'm high and playing the bongo drums right now.
All right, real quick. Like, how much power do we have? And also, like, we're all aware of how the 20th century really plays out, right?
Yeah,
I am. I'm Justin. My friend Brian and I have been traveling through time. We are aware of how the 20th century turns out. And I have just informed Hitler, Mussolini, Churchill, and Lenin that if they continue down the course that they are on now, this will not end well. In fact, Hitler, what we told you before, I know that you're not a politics guy, but we're pretty sure that there is, millions upon millions of your citizens being slaughtered by your government right now. You really got to knock that off.
Oh, like you're perfect. Like you're perfect.
Bookworm over here. It's me, Winston Churchill, laughing at you.
Listen. Can I have a word with my counterpart, Lennon? Hey, Lennon. How seriously married to all this? You know, the proletariat. You know, hooray for everybody, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. You really think that's going to work? No, I really don't. Oh, see, that's what I thought, Lennon. Listen, why don't you would you like to be able to travel through time and space? Yeah, that'd be pretty good. Okay, but seriously, would you like to be able to video conference with other people at the touch of a button? What do you mean by video conference? Like, you pull out a magic object, you look, and there's a picture of them, and there's a picture of you, and you're connected to your...
Okay, but I just remember, Lennon is alternate universe Brian, and he's about to say, is that kind of like hologram conferencing?
Yes. Okay, right. Yes, it's exactly like hologram. Look, the point is, everything could be better if we kind of don't kill millions of people. You realize everybody in this room, we all have the ability to be all like...
Dude, bro, I totally agree. They'd be better. Now, agreed, fewer people, man, when I'm flying around in my jet pack in 2017, Austin, you know, fewer people in the skies would be cooler because then I wouldn't run into as many people. But I hear you. So... Maybe it'd be a little more congested, you know, with their jetpacks and all that. Maybe a little bit more, you know, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, fewer people. I mean, it's pro and con, I understand, but go on.
Okay, look, here's all I'm saying is, as of now.
Would I have won the election and still become governor of Texas if there were more people?
Wait, who am I talking to?
Brian from alternate Austin future, who's Lennon.
Wait, did I become governor of Texas?
Well, yeah. I mean, after you became a billionaire and you had to figure out how to spend the money, you're like, well, why don't I run for governor? And you're like, I don't like politics. Like, we'll take care of it for you.
All right. As long as we're in a sidebar here, real quick, how did I become a billionaire again?
Well, you were the jetpack king of Texas, and then you became the jetpack king of the world. Remember in the garage, you right. built the jetpack system.
But
this
but,
is going to end with them kissing.
Shut up! As we all remember, I famously invented.
Well, no, you would because you're from a different timeline. I understand that. I assume things probably played out pretty much the same way, right?
They have, but I'm having a hard time remembering how did I invent the jetpack again? What was the epiphany?
Well, you were in your garage, and I was in my garage, technically. I mean, to get it precise. I'm inner monologue for Brian Blattner. I was in the garage, right? And I'm like, man, I should do a TV show where I teach magic, right? That would be really cool. And I'm getting ready to make some phone calls to do that. And then I make some emails, and as I did that, my eldest daughter, Jacqueline, knocked over a 2-liter bottle of soda and dropped on some Mentos, and it started spraying. And I said, that's a very interesting reaction because it's not technically a chemical reaction. It's a physical reaction. I wonder if there's other chemicals and materials that I could create these physical reactions with, perhaps, you know, some forms of nitrogen or hydrogen, whatever. And it's a complicated sort of story. And I understand using it for a jetpack was extravagant, and the real money came from just this totally different, you know, thruster system I made in my garage. But long story short, you know.
Okay. Real quick. That sounds super complicated, and I'm thrilled that you made it here, and I'm thrilled that you're Lennon. How is being Lennon working out for you, by the way?
It's an interesting experience. You know, after you've already walked on Mars, you've been governor of Texas, considered a presidential run, you're a multi-billionaire through flying cars and jetpacks and things like that. You know, sure. You want to try different things. So I went to a party with my buddy, Matt McConaughey.
Would you be curious to know how, like, it worked out on my end? Because
my God, I'm sure, because, you know, I had an idea that could have been, you know, the next Google book. You know, I had some great ideas for stuff, you know, that I could have really sure. I think I really could have done something with myself.
Okay, well, on my end, it's a little bit different. I became famous for do you guys have YouTube in your reality? Is that a thing?
Wait a minute. Famous? Like Marlene Dietrich famous? Like, how famous are we talking about? Like, everybody knows your name?
Well, I'll tell you what. Famous like this. Like, we learned from a Brazilian jiu-jitsu master how to disable a haymaker punch. So, here, do me a favor. And I kind of get in a wide stance, and I'm like, Lennon, Brian, come at me, like, with a wild swing, and I'll show you a move I learned on The Modern Rogue.
This one's going to end with them doing more than kissing.
All right. So he throws his wild sort of punch. Ooh.
Right. And so I do exactly like you see in The Modern Rogue. I sweep his hand around the side. I get him pinned. And then I bring my hand up to my chest with his arm pinned. And I break his arm. And then I bring up my forearm right along his windpipe. And I use my other arm as a lever, and I just crack back, and I choke him to death. I murder him with the skills from reality. And I say, shh, don't worry. Nobody will know. It'll be fine. And I kill him.
God, it always ends with you murdering the person.
Every single time.
And then I drag the body away, I rip off his mustache, I put it on me, and I walk out, and I say, "Ah, it is me, Lennon. I am here with new ideas. Brian had a stroke, as he explained to me, amazing ideas that I will explain to you."
And McConaughey Hitler stops the bongo drum, stares at you, and is about to say, "Next time on Journey Quest." Yeah, we went from this was like thinking that you're doing this in front of the room and everybody's shocked to it happened in another room. So reframe. Oh, we got it.
No, I mean, I think I asked for privacy. You know what? Even if we're in the same room, I'd like to think that everybody respected my wish for privacy, that they looked the other way while.
Yeah, no. And listen, man, there's more things going on here. So it maybe wouldn't have been totally out of alignment if you did that in front of everybody, too. So just to recap and try to cap right now, we've got in a bunker. Actually, it's actually Eagle's Nest. It's actually high up in the mountains. We've got Justin. Winston Churchill, who is actually possessed by Justin from an alternate universe. We've got Adolf Hitler, possessed by alternate universe Matthew McConaughey. We've got Brian, and we had Vladimir Lenin. Brian just killed him and now is trying to assume his identity, which maybe maybe he could have done that for the asking. And then we had on speakerphone, we had Bryce-a-lini, Mussolini Bryce.
Bryce-a-lini?
Yeah, so... all very clear. I'm glad, you know, I decided to sort of like simplify the plot line, and I think that's worked out really well.
I think it's pretty linear. I'm about ready to introduce my 9-year-old to it. I think we're good.
Gentlemen, let's do some picks. Brian, you had yours. Do you want to explain what that is again?
Well, a single Reddit thread. Go to the show notes, and it's a fantastic discussion breaking down, because I do perceive, and this is very challenging for me because we are a very pro-science, pro-everything podcast, and yet there really is, both from Neil deGrasse Tyson and from Bill Nye, we are detecting the trappings of dogmatism, and it really bumps me out, man. And I would like to think this is a short-term thing, that is a phase that's going to pass. But in general, as people get older and calcify, they don't tend to stay very open-minded, and all, you know. I would like to hope that we adhere to what makes science great, which is questioning everything. Karl Popper wrote about the importance of falsifiability. And in an age where pop culture blends with the structure of science, I would like to think that the structure of science, the importance of falsifiability remains as the dominant force.
Heartily agree. Heartily agree. Once we forget that it's a process, and the underlying thing to that process is there is no such thing as 100% certainty. That you never stop and say this is a fact. This is incontrovertible. Then you're in a church. That's when it becomes a church. And I see a lot of church-like trappings. And it doesn't mean that a majority of these positions aren't things that I think are likely to be true and that I agree with. It just means that the way I arrive at that and the way I support that comes from I think it's likely true. But I don't think that these things are – I believe reality is absolute. My ability to understand it is imprecise.
I just – the thing that always worries me the most is when we start obsessing about solutions and not problems. And I think that, to me, is the line between science and kind of scientism as it is described, in that, like, there's never an end to the discussion of problems. There's never an end to the discussion of the journey that we take to get to places. What frustrates me is when a conversation about, let's say, something like climate change becomes a binary about the solution. Yeah. That we need to do this specifically because this problem is complex. And it's like, that's what always gets me a little.
Well, we see that with like healthcare. You know, as we can say, like, man, you know, we have a problematic system of, you know, some people not to be able to afford things, you know, pricing's out of control, things like that. And then we go, we need a solution. So anything that comes wrapped in the word solution that it seems on the surface to appeal to people, like, yes, that's what we need. Well, there's a problem here and a problem here and a problem. Well, we have a problem, so anything's better. Like, no, that's not the case. Maybe the case, but maybe not always the case. And that's frustrating because then it becomes like, why are you against solving? It's like, no, I just like the idea that we can actually evaluate these solutions, and maybe inertia is sometimes how you push things through, but it's also how you push war through. It's how you push bad things through, you know? And so, well,
yeah.
In our fantasy land of facts and process and that. So, Justin, you have a pick?
I do. I am going through a little self-imposed experiment, because there is a new service in the Oakland and Berkeley areas called Gig Cars, GIGCARS. They I've seen them on the streets, and then I saw a bunch of ads for them. But basically, it's similar to a service in Austin called Cars to Go, where they have just a bunch of cars out on the street, and you can look up via app where
like
one is.
Car?
You unlock it via an app. It is $2.50 a mile and 30 cents for a car to be parked. But effectively, it is kind of the final car replacement for me. So I'm going to try to use it instead of my car for the next week and just kind of get a sense of it. But if by the end of what my natural expenditures are between that and Uber, I think I might sell my car. And it's one of the first times in a while that I've had technology or a service like this kind of combine enough for me to change the way that I live my life. And you know, be selling my 10-year-old car for whatever I can get for it. But I'm curious to see how it comes out.
Interesting. So this is like Zipcar, but
so not like Zipcar in that Zipcar is kind of more of a rental car, like a streamlined rental car, in that you pick it up from one place and you drop it off at another, you know, sanctioned place. This is literally, you just drive it, and as long as you are parking it in a place that does not turn over for 2 hours, you can just leave it on the street anywhere within their like little map of everything. But it's heavily centralized in my neighborhood, so I can pick it up. And for all the things that I use my car for now, which is primarily going to our office at Guts and Glory, which is a little ways out, you know, now I can get it and do the mail and go to the post office and then drop the car off right by the post office if I want to walk home.
Interesting. I don't know if there's anything really to this whole card sharing sort of, you know, future, guys, this whole economy of that. I don't think of that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool because, like, they're all new cars, which is also nice. Like, I can just get into a car.
Very cool. Let's know how that works out. My pick is the book Tim Wu called The Attention Merchants. And it is a book that's an overview of the advertising industry and how that sort of came about, the idea of when our attention spans became something that were of a commodity. It deals when starting off with like the first newspapers that said, you know what, if we sell the newspaper at a loss, but we make up for it advertising, then that's a different model. And that became a very different model. When you were saying, hey, we're selling you the news, to, hey, we'll get people to read our papers and then we'll sell to advertisers who our customer base is. And it follows the journey of that to radio and early days of radio and how the radio networks initially, all they ever aired was radio networks existed to sell radio sets. TV networks existed to sell TV sets. The idea that the network could be a major moneymaker, that was like kind of like not even sort of something that was on the radar. And then like, well, maybe the money is actually in the content people are consuming on these radios and TVs. And the networks had to be talked into. The first widely broadcast network radio show, networks had to be talked into carrying the show. They had PepsiDent came in and spent $1 million to do it. But the network's like, well, people don't want to listen to this episodic stuff. There's not really a future in episodic broadcasting that every week people tune in to hear some continuing story. But it's your money. Fine. You want to spend it. And that's how the Amos and Andy show became the first widely broadcast show, which was a... Yeah, and, you know, a very racist show, a minstrel show, two white guys playing black people with, you know, all the stereotypes and that. And the theme song was, I did not know this. Do you know what the theme song was for the Amos and Andy show? I don't know if you remember it, Brian, back when we listened to it and we recognized it.
It was The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. You gotta know when to hold them,
No, that was their second choice. First choice was the theme song to the Amos and Andy show was the score to the movie Birth of a Nation.
Oh,
an amazing, amazing landmark in cinema, to be sure, but also a movie that glorifies the KKK. So it's that, it's like Triumph the Will. Man, this movie's really well put together.
Well shot.
This is really evil. This is not turn out well for fans and people who are not fans of this movie. But anyhow, it starts from there. It goes into sort of that and just talking about how at the point at which they realize like, oh, advertising's the driving force for that. And sort of the epiphany of like, oh, well, you know, these things, these mediums are really delivery mechanisms for advertising. You know, the TV shows are just there to capture your attention. And you look at these patterns come up again and again. And you know, we're not at the internet yet, but it's like, man, like, hey, the internet, this thing's really, really cool. How are we going to make money for it? People are going to spend time on it. It's like, it's attention. What's the biggest commodity there? What do we have a lot of? Attention. So let's sell the attention. And that's where Google made its money with AdWords. That's where Facebook made its money. Look at the two, look at the biggest tech companies to come about in the last 20 years that you would see in the top 20 in the stock market, tech companies that aren't like business to business. Okay, Microsoft existed before, Apple existed before, Google and Facebook. What do they sell? Your attention. So
yeah,
right.
So it's a very interesting book. I'm enjoying it. It's very well researched, very thorough, and that's my pick is The Attention Merchants by Tim Wu.
Boom.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this podcast.